Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, September 11th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humble Hunger rises as soups proclaim Hunger Action Month. Jim Shields, editor and publisher of the Mendocino County Observer, passes away at 78. A lawsuit alleges mismanagement and overbilling in wildfire cleanups. So stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
September is Hunger Action Month in Humboldt County, and local food provider staff says the need for food is rising significantly. Daniel Mintz reports.
The director of a local food distribution group says that as local food costs rise, there's also been a huge increase in the number of Humboldt County residents struggling to get enough food. The prevalence of hunger in Humboldt was discussed when the Board of Supervisors proclaimed September as Hunger Action Month at its September 9th meeting. Doing so is an annual practice, but with recent inflation and federal budget cuts, there's a heightened sense of urgency. Carly Robbins, Executive Director of Food for People, summarized her group's goals and said inflation is having a noticeable impact on food insecurity.
Thanks to our dedicated staff, volunteers, and community partners, we're both a safety net and long-term support, helping to meet immediate needs while also supporting long-term stability. So hopefully families don't have to choose between rent and food or rent and medical. Hunger does not discriminate. It affects seniors on low fixed incomes, single parents, veterans, thousands of working residents who just can't keep up with the cost of living here. And the need is growing. Unfortunately, higher costs for gas, food, utilities, medical care, housing have had a sharp increase in food insecurity. In the last 2 years, we've seen a huge increase at Food for People. Many people are seeking food assistance for the very first time in their lives, and we're doing everything we can to meet the need, but we can't do it alone, which is why we appreciate you recognizing this as Hunger Action Month.
Robbins said her group, through its Eureka-based food pantry and a network of partners like the Humboldt Senior Resource Center, distributed 2.6 million pounds of food in the county last year, serving more than 21,000 people a month. The network also includes schools and community resource centers reaching every area of the county. Robbins said food services have recently expanded to southern Humboldt locations like Alder Point, Petrolia, Honeydew, and Myers Flat. Food for People Development Director David Reed said hunger is a national and county problem affecting thousands of local children, and recent federal budget cuts will make the numbers grow.
At a time when the cost of basic needs like groceries and healthcare is out of reach for millions, hunger in America is a crisis. 1 in 5 kids face hunger, and that's more than 13 million children nationwide, and more than 5,000, almost 6,000 children here in Humboldt County. In some of our local school districts, more than 80% of kids qualify for free and reduced lunches. With recent national changes to food assistance for food banks and programs like SNAP and CalFresh, millions more Americans will soon face deep food insecurity.
Supervisors acknowledged hunger issues, with Supervisor Rex Bone saying, quote, "There isn't a member up here that hasn't got a phone call asking, where can I get help?" Board Chair Michelle Bushnell noted the Food for People Network's reach to rural communities.
I'll echo my colleagues and want to say that I appreciate, especially in my district, the areas that you have gone that are very rural, Blacksburg and Alder Point. I have gone there on occasion just to see people, and it's very well anticipated and used, and is really, those folks are sometimes don't have cars, sometimes don't have transportation, and so it's such a great service that is in those very rural communities.
Read aloud by Supervisor Natalie Arroyo, the proclamation says 16.7% of the county faces food insecurity, and almost 30,000 Humboldt residents are in the state's CalFresh program, 26% of them children. Declaring September as Hunger Action Month, the proclamation, quote, "encourages the community to learn more about hunger and take action to ensure that every Humboldt County resident every day has enough to eat. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
On September 3rd, James Jim Shields of Laytonville passed away at 78. From 1989 to 2025, Shields edited and published the Mendocino County Observer, as well as served as district manager of the Laytonville County Water District. Shields was born on March 1, 1947, in Bloomington, Illinois, to Robert E. Shields and Lois Plotz Shields. He married Susan Staley on October 6, 1981, who preceded him in death in 2013. In the late 70s to mid-80s, Shields worked in the airline industry employed by Western Airlines. During this time, he was voted in as the president of the Airline Transport Employees Union. He also later served on the board of directors of Western Airlines. Shields and his family moved to Laytonville in 1987, and 2 years later bought the Laytonville Ledger, which was then rebranded as the Mendocino County Observer. KMUD News spoke with Jama Shields Spence, Shields' daughter, for more about her father's life and work.
So my father, Jim Shields, was the editor and publisher of the Mendocino County Observer, and our family moved to the Laytonville area in 1987. And at that time, there was a newspaper in Laytonville called the Laytonville Ledger, and it went up for sale in the late 80s. And my family previous to moving to Mendocino County, worked in the airline industry in both the Bay Area and Los Angeles. My dad was a president of a union for Western Airlines employees. And so neither one of my parents really had any type of journalist or newspaper experience, but they were looking for something new and exciting to do. And so they purchased the Laytonville Ledger in 1989 and then rebranded the newspaper as the Mendocino County Observer. And at the time, I was only 5 years old, so I rely on the historical context of others for that time period. But I was told by a few friends and family members that at the time, the Laytonville Ledger was really more of like a conservative viewpoint of issues that were happening in the Laytonville area. It was sort of like way that like press releases got put out about like Chamber of Commerce events and like sports events and things like that. It didn't really have any coverage of like political issues. And at the time, the timber wars were the main issue in our area. And so my dad started covering those and sort of took it from a different perspective, which a lot of like the old timers and people in the logging industry didn't appreciate his viewpoint. So we actually had people pull out of their subscriptions and some of the business owners pulled their ads as sort of like a protest to the new wave of journalism that was coming upon the Laytonville area.
In the late 90s, Shields served as the chairman of the Laytonville Area Municipal Advisory Council, where he founded the county's Municipal Advisory Councils, or MAC system. The MAC system was a way for unincorporated communities like Laytonville to be able to advise their local representatives on pressing issues.
Absolutely. Yeah. So like I said in the beginning, my parents bought the newspaper in the early 90s, really. And through his work, you know, as sort of like a community watchdog and an advocate, people began to bring him into, you know, their circles and to ask for advice and how to solve problems within the community. And he really did love that work. He loved being asked to help solve problems. And even though he was a busy guy, he never made you feel like he didn't have time for that. And I think it was the mid-90s, my dad, along with our third district supervisor, who also recently passed away, Johnny Pinches, they got together and formed what is now known as the MAC system, which is the Municipal Advisory Councils, which was a way that the state government allowed unincorporated areas to still have a voice with elected representatives. So, for example, Laytonville is in an unincorporated area of Mendocino County, so we have no city government. The MAC system was a way for our community to be able to have like a direct line with the county to be able to voice their opinions and concerns on issues that would impact them.
Shields was known as a local government watchdog, where he advocated for workers' rights and for good government. His wife, Susan, was also heavily involved in the community, forming the North Pole Toy Express with their friend Pam Cornell. Now it is known as Pam and Susan's Toy Express. Shields also served as a longtime district manager for the Laytonville County Water District, a job he got when approached by the Water District for advice in the early 2000s.
My mom, Susan, who passed away about 10 years ago, along with their friend Pam, they formed a Laytonville toy drive. So each year we continue the tradition in their honor, where we gift presents and Christmas dinners with our local church, the Church of Divine Lineage, to over 100 Laytonville families. So that's something that he founded with my mom and a friend. With the Water District, my mom and dad's office is above the Laytonville Post Office, and the Water District was across the hallway at the time. And they were facing some pretty serious problems. They had failing infrastructure, and they were, I think, on the kind of the verge of bankruptcy. And so they walked across the hallway, and some of their board members and staff said, "Jim, how do we solve this problem?" And so he began getting more involved with the work of the Water District. And the next thing you know, he's hired on as the Water District Manager for the Laytonville County Water District. And that was in the early 2000s.
Shields' daughter, Jaymo, continues the family tradition of community work through the nonprofit Laytonville Healthy Start. The nonprofit is a community resource center that stewards projects for community spaces in Laytonville. She also is currently running the Mendocino County Observer in her late father's absence.
So both my parents were really hardworking people and dedicated to the community, and just for as long as I can remember, always giving more than they ever received, and definitely instilled that in me. I believe in the value of hard work and, you know, good ethics and being a good neighbor and a good community member. And through that work, I run a nonprofit called Laytonville Healthy Start. We're a community and family resource center. And through that work, we've stewarded many community projects, such as bringing a library to Laytonville, and that we built a skate park here. We're just here to help our community in a variety of ways. And I feel like my parents' passion for just supporting the community and just, you know, always helping others who were in need really instilled, you know, my values today and why I do what I do. So yeah, it was like, you know, you didn't have a choice. You worked hard and you gave back to your community. That's how I was raised.
The future of the Observer is currently uncertain, as there are issues with ownership and legalities of the newspaper. Shields Spence explains further the importance of keeping the Observer running, as well as other independent publications like it.
Yeah, so right now I'm honestly kind of wading through some complicated issues in terms of the ownership and the legalities of the newspaper. So at this point, I'm fairly uncertain what will happen with it in this day and age. My desire is to keep it going in some form or another. We have a lot of people supporting the newspaper. A lot of our readers and writers believe in it. I personally believe in the power of local media and local journalism. You know, we're a family-owned and operated newspaper, which in this day and age is basically unheard of. You know, many newspapers from our area are corporate-owned, so they're either owned by like the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times. And so we're one of very few independent newspapers that's left in California. And so the struggle is real in terms of supporting, you know, local journalism and, you know, keeping it alive. But if I can wade through kind of the murky waters that I'm in right now, we're going to figure out a way to keep it going.
The Mendocino County Observer is still accepting submissions and support during this transitional period. For more information, the email address is jama@laytonville.org, and the number for the Observer is 707-984-6223. A little-known trial recently concluded in a Sacramento court where allegations of mismanagement and gross overbilling were leveled at a state agency and contractors working to clean up debris and toxic waste left by devastating wildfires. Ryan Hudson has been looking into the story for us and spoke to KMA Sigurbjorn.
During a prolonged fire season, as California has been devastated by one wildfire after another, an underpublished trial took place in Sacramento, focusing on what happens after the fires have been put out, namely the cleanup that takes place once the firefighters have left. Removal of debris and leftover contamination is becoming an ever bigger business in the state. Cleanup operations are overseen by the California Office of Emergency Services and Cal Recycle, but the work itself is farmed out to contracting companies following a bidding process. During the trial, allegations of staggering overbilling and dishonest business practices were leveled at the cleanup companies in the aftermath of several large fires in 2018, including the Camp Fire that devastated the town of Paradise in Butte County. News of this trial was virtually non-existent until reporter Kevin Rechter published an article about it in the LA Times earlier this week. We asked our colleague Ryan Hudson to look into the trial to see if any of its tentacles reached Humboldt, Mendocino, or the surrounding counties. Ryan, to begin with, what is this case about? Because I gather it was not about the cleanup process and the alleged malpractice per se.
Essentially, this case revolves around the termination of an employee working for the state in the Office of Emergency Services, which sort of oversees all things in the category of disaster. They handled COVID, a lot of that management, for example. They handle a lot of fire mitigation efforts and that kind of stuff. So that's where this article comes in.
And what is it that this employee of the California Office of Emergency Services, Steve Larson is his name, alleging led to his termination?
The complaints and the things that he brought to his superiors revolve around cleanup of toxic debris and sort of the aftermath, where we have large wildfires in Northern California and in other areas where the state has been in charge of sort of handling that response. So they're alleging that there has been mismanagement in the way that toxic debris has been removed and calculated, if you will. So the funding that they've paid out to these individual contractors, that debris cleanup, the toxic waste, all of that sort of remediating the environment and getting in there and cleaning it up for future use, they have basically overextended themselves in terms of over invoicing, over billing, like they're way beyond their target, according to this reporting by Kevin Rector of the LA Times.
And we're talking about stunning figures here. According to an audit done on one of these operations, an additional $457 million were charged that were not included in the initial bid. So tell us, Ryan, what companies were mentioned in the suit, and have they been involved in cleanup of any fires that are closer to us than the campfire?
The three main companies that are cited within this article to have allegedly done inappropriate billing for their cleanup work are Environmental Chemical Corporation, abbreviated as ECC. Then you've got a company called Tetra Tech. And then the third big one is a company called Arcadis. And Arcadis was active, for example, in the campfire in Butte County. Everybody remembers that Town of Paradise. That was a big one in 2018. They also have been active in cleaning up wildfires from 2020 in Northern California. And that's the same deal with Tetra Tech, who also was cleaning up in the Mendocino Complex fire in Northern California and the Carr fire. Those are both from 2018, the Thomas fire and the Mendocino Complex fire as well. And then for Environmental Chemical Corporation, they're listed as having been involved in cleanup in 2017, various fires that overlap between Mendocino, Lake County, and Napa. So they have those fires in common, these three different companies.
Now, it's important to state that none of these companies were on trial. The case was brought against California Office of Emergency Services by Steve Larson for wrongful dismissal. The companies themselves have denied any wrongdoing, as has the Office of Emergency Services, maintaining that all their practices were above board and that the alleged overbilling was for legitimate work done outside of the scope of the bid. Nevertheless, the allegations made during the trial and the sums mentioned are staggering. And if there are fresh developments that relate to this case in the future, KMUD will of course bring you news of it, especially in relation to cleanup operations in Humboldt and its neighboring counties. Thank you, Ryan.
No problem. Thank you.
In state news, California parents can get help with medical costs not covered by insurance. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Medical debt can be crushing for parents of children with significant health challenges, even with insurance. But a program from United Healthcare Children's Foundation may be able to help California families. The program has given out 40,000 grants since 2005, totaling more than $80 million. The grants cover therapies, prescriptions, and medical devices that may not be covered by health insurance. Scott Otto is Assistant Executive Director for the foundation.
Grants can be awarded up to $5,000 per child per year. Each family may have two or three or more kids, so each of those children are independently eligible to apply up to a $10,000 lifetime.
To be eligible, families do have to be enrolled in a commercial health insurance plan, but it can be from any company. 4 out of 5 families that apply have no connection to United Healthcare. Families that have secondary coverage through Medi-Cal are also eligible. To apply, go to uhccf.org. A 2024 survey from the California Healthcare Foundation found that 38% of people in the state and more than half of low-income families report having medical debt. Otto says the grant program is targeted to help middle and low-income families.
Then there's also some income requirements. So an example, a family of four, the upper limit for income is right around $145,000. So pretty generous when I think of, you know, that upper threshold.
A 2025 report from the UC Berkeley Labor Center found that nationally, 52% of adults between the ages of 30 and 49 carry health care debt. And of that group, parents are 22% more likely to owe money for medical bills compared to those who do not have children. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Missouri House passes GOP redistricting plan. Dems vow to keep fighting racist rollback of rights, KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
Missouri House Republicans passed the Republican redistricting plan Tuesday on a vote of 90-65, sending the measure to the state Senate for further action. Missouri has 8 congressional seats, with 2 currently held by Democrats. The new map would eliminate one of those 2 seats by targeting a Democrat-held district in Kansas City. Democrat Ashley Aune of Kansas City spoke against the redistricting plan during the House debate.
We now have 3 rural Republicans representing pieces of Kansas City. Whose priority is that going to be?
In the final vote, 13 Republicans joined Democrats in opposing the measure. The vote sends it to the Senate next, but the fight is not over, according to Democratic State Representative Ray Reed.
The Senate is not over. We are still here. We're not going anywhere. It's about not being afraid to bring the fight directly to Republicans and call them out on bending the knee to President Trump.
He says if we allow Trump to illegally keep control of Congress by redistricting ahead of the elections, there will be no check on the president. The Congressional Black Caucus is also blasting the redistricting plans in Missouri, Texas, and beyond. Yvette Clark is chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. She spoke at a news conference Tuesday.
Republicans are scrambling to cling to power. So let me be clear. We are not going back. President Trump and his Republican allies are determined to drag this country back to a time when black voices were shut out of the democratic process. And we will not allow it. Our communities fought long and hard for the right to choose our representatives. This desperate attempt to rig elections and erode black political power will be met with fierce resistance.
Texas has already enacted its Republican redistricting plan, followed by California's Democratic redistricting in response. There are moves to redraw districts also in Republican-led Indiana and Florida, and in Democratic Maryland and New York. At the Congressional Black Caucus News Conference, Democratic Representative Emmanuel Cleaver of Missouri spoke out against the redistricting wave. He's the Democrat whose seat would be eliminated by the Missouri redistricting plan. He calls the Missouri legislature out of control, saying there are powers trying to place this nation in the 1950s.
And when our children and their children look back upon this moment, they're going to wonder, what were they thinking? How could they have made so much progress only to have it reversed? I think that this is one of the ugliest moments. I grew up in the South. This is one of the ugliest moments I've seen and felt. in my lifetime. And it seems that there are people who are just hell-bent on creating division, trying to divide every group, everybody from everybody. And if it continues, Lord help us.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And in national Native news, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is national Native news. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. During World War II, at least 100,000 Japanese Americans were forced into so-called internment camps across the U.S., seen by the government as a potential threat within America's borders. Memories of the mass incarceration still burns hot for former prisoners and their families. Senior reporter Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on a Native American college that held a special dedication to preserve that history.
About 200 people gathered at the Snow Country Prison Japanese American Memorial last week at the United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. Taiko and Native drummers performed together as dignitaries honored the 1,850 Japanese men who were confined here back when the site was known as Fort Lincoln. Satsuki Ina was born in a California internment camp in 1944, and her father, Itaru, was kept at Fort Lincoln in 1945 through 1946. Her book, The Poet and the Silk Girl, is a memoir based on her parents' letters, diaries, and her father's haiku. The memorial is the culmination of 25 years that Ina and the UTTC worked together to preserve this history.
There were trees that the Japanese-American prisoners had planted, and there was this story that there were ghosts that wandered around, and that when the wind blew on these trees, it sounded like somebody was crying. So there was actually a healer that would come every once in a while and bless those trees. So when I heard stories like that, I felt like the memory of their presence was really being protected and honored.
Ina says there are efforts by the Trump administration to erase or dismiss past atrocities against communities of color. So she sees the UTTC's support, including giving some of its property to the memorial, as key to keeping history accurate and the government accountable.
This is, in many ways, an act of solidarity with the Native people and the Japanese Americans. And the lesson is, it's in our collaboration, our solidarity with each other, that we strengthen our truths and stand in opposition to efforts to erase our history, to alter it, to rewrite our narratives in ways that don't talk about the truth.
At the end of the dedication ceremony, a Japanese and Native flute player performed together as visitors placed paper crayons on the names of those incarcerated at Fort Lincoln. These were inscribed on slate tiles that once lined the barracks. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Bismarck.
Over the summer at the University of South Dakota, 20 high school students attended the annual Oscar House Summer Art Institute, learning from each other and renowned Native American artists. The camps inspired by artist Oscar Howe, who paved the way for Native artists to challenge stereotypes, teaching at the university for more than two decades. Instructor Keith Braveheart helped students learn about Howe's approach to art, recounting his first experience with the Trailblazers' legacy.
It felt like the work was alive, like it was physically breathing, like it was pulsating. And I know that it could have been an optical illusion because of the way that he designs his work, but I also later would truly believe that it was imbued with a Dakota spirit.
Braveheart studied in one of the Institute's many iterations as a student.
I see this potential that what was my path, my journey, what that could be like, might be similar to a next generation of an artist, a younger artist.
A citizen of the Oglala Sioux tribe, Braveheart says he thinks creating those future pathways is what Oscar Howe envisioned. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Sigurd Bjorn, Ryan Hudson, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kma.org. Interested in reporting on news in the Mendocino area? KMA News is currently looking for Mendocino Stringer reporters. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just looking to report on real stories happening in your community, we'll supply you with the training and support you need to get started. If you're interested, email news@kma.org. Redwood Community News, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.